Notably, advances in live communications have significantly curtailed the powers and responsibilities enjoyed by Navy commanders. Although there remain vestigial cultural differences between the forces, Perry's contemporary equivalents are kept under Grant-like wraps. This is for seemingly good reason. Why have an admiral act on behalf of the president when the president can pick up the phone and call any leader in the world? Why have a ship's captain make decisions in a vacuum when you can have his, presumably older, wiser, more experienced superiors monitor his actions and provide instruction? Similarly, the advent of the telegraph in the late 1800s took away what little expeditionary authority army officers in the West once had. In short, when they can see what's going on, leaders understandably want to control what's going on. Empowerment tends to be a tool of last resort. We can call this tethering of visibility to control the Perry principle. Command by negation, a concept unique to naval command and control, allows a subordinate commander the freedom to operate as he or she thinks best, keeping authorities informed of decisions taken until the senior overrides a decision. The Navy is the only service that uses the acronym UNODIR, unless otherwise directed, by which a commanding officer informs the boss of a proposed course of action, and only if the boss overrides it will it not be taken. The subordinate is informing the boss, not asking permission. Taylor's contemporary, Henri Fayol, enumerated the five functions of management as planning, organizing, commanding, coordinating, and controlling. The last three become much easier to attend to when you have more information, creating a cycle of seeking ways to gather and centralize more information in order to push more and more efficient directives to the organization. The function of workers is to feed this cycle and await the next commands. Today's managers have access to all kinds of information about their employees that they lacked just a few years ago. Communication and monitoring technologies like those we used in Iraq or Sandy Pentland used in his experiments on idea flow enable higher-ups to analyze macro trends in their markets to keep tabs on how many minutes an individual employee spends resting versus working. Automated systems at restaurants monitor waiters' movements, tracking every ticket, dish, and drink, searching for patterns that suggest efficacy as well as those correlated to theft. All of this enables the habitual centralization of power. In Iraq, senior leaders like me enjoyed unprecedented insight into every second and square foot of our task force's endeavors. I could watch operations in real time and speak to operators in the middle of a firefight, although I never did for reasons that will be explained later in the chapter. On many occasions, we were able, almost instantly, to link together naval headquarters in Bahrain, ships operating off the Horn of Africa, Central Command in Tampa, Florida, the Pentagon, our teams on the ground in Africa, and other supporting elements to coordinate sensitive actions. This led us to tighten our grasp on decision-making. But as we continued to watch and learn from AQI, we asked ourselves whether perhaps something had changed. We had access to more real-time information than any force in the history of warfare. But to what end? While military leaders a century ago yearned for the ability to see and control more of their battlefield, their heirs today have been inundated with too much of a good thing. At our headquarters, I had simultaneous access to live updates and real-time video from offices and operations across the world, and was connected to almost every decision of consequence. This was great for establishing holistic awareness, but it also created a nightmare of paperwork and approvals, time that could otherwise have been spent solving real problems. Like other staples of managerial thinking, the Perry principle made sense in a world that no longer exists, but offers little help when the velocity and volume of decisions needing to be made so exceed the capabilities of even the most gifted leaders that empowerment of those on lower rungs is simply a necessity. In Iraq, we could see that our sharing of information was an effective tool. But the centralization of control that came with such access to tactical data was another question entirely. Centuries of technological and managerial development suggested that the Perry principle of extending control and empowering only as a last resort was a good rule. But the rules of engagement had changed. I began to reconsider the nature of my role as a leader. The wait for my approval was not resulting in any better decisions, and our priority should be reaching the best possible decision that could be made in a time frame that allowed it to be relevant. I came to realize that in normal cases, I did not add tremendous value. So, I changed the process. I communicated across the command my thought process on decisions like airstrikes and told them to make the call. Whoever made the decision, I was always ultimately responsible, and more often than not, those below me reached the same conclusion I would have. But this way, our team would be empowered to do what was needed. The practice of relaying decisions up and down the chain of command is premised on the assumption that the organization has the time to do so, or, more accurately, that the cost of the delay is less than the cost of the errors produced by removing a supervisor. In 2004, this assumption no longer held. The risks of acting too slowly were higher than the risks of letting competent people make judgment calls. We concluded that we would be better served by accepting the 70% solution today, rather than satisfying protocol and getting the 90% solution tomorrow. In the military, you learn that you will never have time for the 100% solution. I did not expect a bad outcome, but I watched to see how we would do. Use good judgment in all situations. The Ritz-Carlton hotel chain has spent a century building a reputation for quality, luxury, and reliability. Through recessions, depressions, corporate mergers, and world wars, the brand, originally a restaurant operated on high-end cruise ships, then a hotel that earned founder César Ritz the sobriquet King of Hoteliers and Hotelier to Kings, has remained at the top of the food chain. Today, the company operates 85 hotels in 30 countries and regularly tops the Zagat lists for its hotels and dining. In particular, it has earned a reputation for offering outstanding service. It is César Ritz who is credited with the line, now a universal law in the hospitality industry, that the customer is always right. Nearly 50,000 executives from other companies have traveled to the Ritz-Carlton Learning Institute and Ritz-Carlton Leadership Center to learn how they, too, can achieve such quality of service. One might think that this is a result of careful oversight and exacting requirements drilled into the Ritz's customer-facing employees, that outstanding service arises from a set of painstakingly detailed protocols. In fact, the company's approach to HR is famous for the freedom it grants. Employees can spend up to $2,000 to satisfy guests or deal with issues that arise. A Harvard Business School case study detailed this and other extraordinary policies, such as the fact that the Ritz trains all its employees to break away from their duties if a guest needs something special and encourages employees to use their empowerment. One of the basics that employees are given is instant guest pacification is the responsibility of each employee. Whoever receives a complaint will own it, resolve it to the guest's satisfaction, and record it. A similar approach was taken at Nordstrom, the department store chain known for its almost mythic levels of assistance to customers. New employees are issued a card that reads, "Welcome to Nordstrom. We're glad to have you with our company. Our number one goal is to provide outstanding customer service. Set both your personal and professional goals high. We have great confidence in your ability to achieve them, so our employee handbook is very simple. We have only one rule." Flipping the card over reveals the company's single rule. Our one rule: use good judgment in all situations. Please feel free to ask your department manager, store manager, or human resources officer any question at any time. Since the 1980s, when companies began experimenting with empowerment, the buzzword that summarizes what we called decentralization of decision-making authority, myriad studies in the social sciences have concluded that this psychological difference of empowerment has a very real impact. Jay Conger and Rabindra Kanungo's 1988 paper, The Empower Process, Integrating Theory and Practice, noted that empowerment improved employee satisfaction. Kenneth W. Thomas and Betty A. Velthaus identified the decentralization of authority as creating intrinsic task motivation. Studies have found this effect in domains ranging from nursing in China to five-star hotels in Turkey. The scientific management model, by contrast, was described by one of Taylor's disciples as resting primarily upon two important elements. First, absolutely rigid and inflexible standards throughout your establishment. Second, that each employee of your establishment should receive every day clear-cut, definite instructions as to just what he is to do and how he is to do it, and these instructions should be exactly carried out, whether they are right or wrong. Today, even the most clockwork of tasks, like factory floor labor and other mechanical tasks, can benefit from some degree of innovation and creative thinking. The less people's jobs can be automated, the more you need them to take initiative, innovate, and think creatively. But despite the evidence of all these studies, few managers are willing to take this leap. Today, only 20% of workers feel empowered and act resourcefully. Most feel disenfranchised or locked down. With rising interdependence and unpredictability, the costs of micromanagement are increasing. Roosevelt Moss Cantor of Harvard Business School, a pioneer in the study of empowerment in the workplace, sums up the imperative of extending authority downward. As world events become ever more disruptive, the number of exceptions and change requirements go up, and companies must rely on more and more of their people to make decisions on matters for which a routine response may not exist. She concludes, "The degree to which the opportunity to use power effectively is granted to or withheld from individuals is one operative difference between those companies which stagnate and those which innovate." In other words, as our environment erupts with too many possibilities to plan for effectively, we must become comfortable sharing power. In a Harvard Business Review article, Josh Bernoff and Ted Shadler argue, "In a world where one angry tweet can torpedo a brand, corporations need to unleash their employees to fight back." Citing United Airlines' sluggish response to Dave Carroll's broken guitar both before and after he posted his video, they assert that a new approach is needed, one in which team players do not have to consult with the coach before taking a shot. United is just one of many companies to suffer viral scandals. Blogger Heather Armstrong took to Twitter to vent her frustration with Maytag. Greenpeace assaulted Nestle's Facebook page about their environmental policies. Comcast found itself in the midst of unwanted attention after a subscriber posted a recording of his conversation with a representative who refused to let him cancel his service. The Internet has made individual consumers vastly more powerful. As Bernoff and Shadler observe, anyone with a smartphone or a computer can inflict lasting brand damage. But for the most part, employees charged with responding to consumer complaints remain more restricted than ever by the Perry Principle. The organization has, in most cases, not evolved to mimic its protean environment. The asymmetry is a recipe for disaster. If the first United representative Carroll had spoken to had had the authority to address his issue, the company could have avoided embarrassment and might have acquired an advocate. Electronics chain Best Buy has tried to do just that. Using a system called TwelpForce, employees were enabled to respond on Best Buy's behalf on Twitter. When an iPhone bought from Best Buy broke, and the consumer started tweeting that the in-store staff did not do him justice, instead of offering him a replacement iPhone, they gave him a BlackBerry, a customer service representative saw the tweet, swooped in, responded, and arranged for him to have an iPhone the next day. Best Buy, Bernoff and Shadler write, was just as susceptible to online customer complaints as any other company, but because it's run differently, it can respond differently. Far better than trying to prevent such activity is to acknowledge that your employees have technology power. Armed with technology, your employees can build solutions at the speed of today's connected customers. Cantor foresaw that increased disruption and unpredictability would necessitate increased agility and adaptability, which could be achieved only by loosening control. AQI had empowered its operatives, not only with technology, but with decision-making authority. While our operators struggled to respond under codes designed to align with the Perry Principle. This is just what we wanted in the task force. We accepted that divergences from plan were inevitable. We wanted to improve our ability to respond to them. We needed to empower our teams to take action on their own. As long as it is not immoral or illegal. As an instinctive perfectionist, it pained me to do it. But I began pushing authority further down the chain of command. Empowerment did not always take the form of an overt delegation. More often, my more self-confident subordinates would make decisions, many far above their pay grade, and simply inform me. My response, often very publicly conveyed during our O&I, typically endorsed their initiative and created a multiplier effect, whereby more and more people, seeing the success of their peers, would begin taking more matters into their own hands. Like the directors of Ritz-Carlton and Nordstrom, I found that, by ignoring the Perry Principle and containing my desire to micromanage, I flipped a switch in my subordinates. They had always taken things seriously, but now they acquired a gravitas that they had not had before. It is one thing to look at a situation and make a recommendation to a senior leader about whether or not to authorize a strike. Psychologically, it is an entirely different experience to be charged with making that decision. junior officers, instead of handing the decision to me and providing guidance, were now entrusted with the responsibility of a decision that was, quite literally, often a matter of life and death. Eventually, a rule of thumb emerged. If something supports our effort, as long as it is not immoral or illegal, you could do it. Soon, I found that the question I most often asked my force was, "What do you need?" We decentralized until it made us uncomfortable, and it was right there, on the brink of instability, that we found our sweet spot. There were growing pains. Some subordinate leaders tried to hold authority at their level, and on a number of occasions I had to confirm to partner agencies or units that a decision voiced by someone in the task force had my approval. Often I was hearing about the decision for the first time, but I cannot remember a time when I failed to support it. On the whole, our initiative, which we call Empowered Execution, met with tremendous success. Like shared consciousness, this term was coined not during the task force years, but during the course of our subsequent research at CrossLead. Decisions came more quickly, critical in a fight where speed was essential to capturing enemies and preventing attacks. More important and more surprising, we found that even as speed increased and we pushed authority further down, the quality of decisions actually went up. We had decentralized on the belief that the 70% solution today would be better than the 90% solution tomorrow. But we found our estimates were backward. We were getting the 90% solution today instead of the 70% solution tomorrow. This took us by surprise and upended a lot of conventional assumptions about the superior wisdom of those at the top. Understanding the underlying causes of this unexpected outcome proved essential to sustaining and enhancing it. A piece of this is the psychology of decision-making. An individual who makes a decision becomes more invested in its outcome. Another factor was that, for all our technology, our leadership simply did not understand what was happening on the ground as thoroughly as the people who were there. The ability to see video footage and hear gunfire from an operation as it unfolded was a tremendous asset. But a commander on the ground can comprehend the complexity of a situation in ways that defy the visual and audible. Everything from temperature and fatigue to personalities. I had been a baseball pitcher in my youth and knew that often the man on the mound knows what he's best postured to throw. But the key reason for the success of empowered execution lay in what had come before it. The foundation of shared consciousness. This relationship between contextual understanding and authority is not new. Every captain was a Nelson. During this period, I found myself pondering an exceptional example of the Navy's traditional embrace of empowerment and asking myself what exactly made it work. On my daily runs parallel to Ballad's long runway, I would listen to the audiobook of Adam Nicholson's Seize the Fire about Admiral Nelson. Nelson's genius as a leader had been his nurturing of the independent decision-making abilities of his subordinates, described by Nicholson as entrepreneurs of battle. As we discussed in Chapter 1, Nelson's wily perpendicular attack at Trafalgar created the chaos in which his force could thrive, and his enemies, trained to follow flags and bearing little knowledge of the overall strategy, flailed. Nelson had told his commanders, "No captain can do very wrong if he places his ship alongside that of the enemy. But that broad authority could have gone terribly wrong if he had not spent decades cultivating their individual qualities as decision makers, and if they had lacked an overall understanding of the force and the battle as a whole. This was Nelson's equivalent of shared consciousness, and it was only because of it that his captains could thrive as empowered agents in a chaotic melee. For most of my career in the Army, my mess dress uniform bore light blue lapels that signaled I was in the infantry. Artillery wore red. Special forces wore green. Tankers wore yellow. Our uniforms, stripes, badges, tabs, and insignia announced our rank, qualifications, and experience, our box in the org chart. They also bolstered our sense of identity. Of course, I believed that every branch mattered, but for 24 and a half years after I graduated from West Point, I knew blue mattered a bit more. But when I was promoted to Brigadier General in January 2001, my lapels changed to black, indistinguishable from those of generals who had ascended through the medical corps, engineers, or aviation. A general is expected to have general knowledge of the Army, blue, red, green, and everything in between. It is because they have this general knowledge that leaders can be trusted to make major decisions. In 2004, we were asking every operator to think like someone with black lapels. In other words, like Nelson's captains. We were working to pump general officer information and awareness throughout our ranks, giving people used to tight orders and limited visibility the insights once reserved for people at the top. In the old model, subordinates provided information and leaders disseminated commands. We reversed it. We had our leaders provide information so that subordinates, armed with context, understanding, and connectivity, could take the initiative and make decisions. Shared consciousness meant that people at every level on our org chart now enjoyed access to the kind of perspective once limited to senior leaders. The term empowerment gets thrown around a great deal in the management world, but the truth is that simply taking off constraints is a dangerous move. It should be done only if the recipients of newfound authority have the necessary sense of perspective to act on it wisely. At Trafalgar, Nelson's redistribution of authority was put to the ultimate test. A few hours into the battle, a sharpshooter on the Redoubtable, the enemy ship with which Nelson's victory had locked masts, fired a shot that hit Nelson in the shoulder and became lodged in his back. The wound was incapacitating and clearly fatal. While Nelson's men carried their dying admiral below decks, the battle reached its climax. In the raging noise and violence, few noticed his absence. He died about 3 hours later, having lived just long enough to know of his victory. "To any other nation, the loss of a Nelson would have been irreparable," said French Vice Admiral Villeneuve after the battle. "But in the British fleet off Cadiz, every captain was a Nelson." We wanted our force to exhibit the entrepreneurial mindset of those British captains, so we nurtured holistic awareness and tried to give everyone a stake in the fight. When we stopped holding them back, when we gave them the order simply to place their ship alongside that of the enemy, they thrived. The Visible Man Model of Decision Making. He was just 15 inches tall and made of plastic, but he left an enduring impression on me. The brainchild of Marcel Jovine, a former Italian soldier who came to America as a POW in World War II, The visible man was a plastic anatomical toy introduced by the Renwall Products Company in the fall of 1958. He cost $4.98, and his clear plastic body held a skeleton and organs that could be removed and replaced. My older brother Scott had one, and I remember concluding that because we could see through the transparent skin of the body, we could get a general idea of what was going on inside. I thought about how much easier doctors' jobs would be if real humans were similarly designed. Seeing might save a lot of exploratory surgery. Though I never caught anyone, I suspect that eye-rolling was common when I referred time and again to the visible man during the task force video teleconferences. I told subordinates that if they provided me with sufficient, clear information about their operations, I would be content to watch from a distance. If they did not, I would describe in graphic terms the exploratory surgery necessary to gain the situational awareness I needed. They were free to make all the decisions they wanted, as long as they provided the visibility that, under shared consciousness, had become standard. By 2006, we had transformed the way we observed, assessed, acted, and interacted in all our operations. At Balad, our screens usually streamed FMV, full motion video, transmitted down from a Predator UAV or manned surveillance aircraft providing a real-time view of somewhere in Iraq, Afghanistan, or elsewhere in the region. Sometimes instead they would display an operations log or chat room reflecting the latest updates provided by task forces across the region. We would watch our helicopters land in a cloud of dust and operators move swiftly toward their targets. Explosions could temporarily white out the screen, and small arms fire looked like fireflies briefly illuminating the night. Logs would mirror what we saw. Aircraft on ground. Target contained, surrounded. And hopefully, jackpot, which indicated that the individual targeted on the mission had been captured or sometimes killed. My laptop had special software that enabled me to monitor and speak to any part of our force on internal radio nets. In real time, I could see what was happening, hear the operators' internal discussions, and read their ongoing reporting. For a closet micromanager, it was a new opportunity to pull the puppet strings from great distances. But I did not do that. I never told operators what to do on a raid. It would have been a mistake. I'd learned that seeing the conditions on the ground, hearing the tone and content of a radio call, having situational awareness of what was happening and why, helped me do my part of the task better, not to reach in and do theirs. It was counterintuitive. But it reflected exactly the approach to decision-making that we needed to pervade our force. Eyes on, hands off. I was most effective when I supervised processes, from intelligence operations to the prioritization of resources, ensuring that we avoided the silos or bureaucracy that doomed agility, rather than making individual operational decisions. When we tried to do the same things tighter and faster under the constraints of the old system, we managed to increase the number of raids per month from 10 to 18. By 2006, under the new system, this figure skyrocketed to 300. With minimal increases in personnel and funding, we were running 17 times faster. And these raids were more successful. We were finding a higher percentage of our targets, due in large part to the fact that we were finally moving as fast as AQI, but also because of the increased quality of decision-making. Eyes on, hands off represented a complete reverse of the Perry principle. If we could see it, we would not need to try to control it. As it turned out, this would also require a rethought approach to personal leadership.
Recap. Traditionally, organizations have implemented as much control over subordinates as technology physically allowed. New technologies offer today's leaders unprecedented opportunities to gather information and direct operations. But because of the speed necessary to remain competitive, centralization of power now comes at great cost. While shared consciousness had helped us overcome the interdependence of the environment, speed, the second ingredient of complexity, still posed a challenge. Effective adaptation to emerging threats and opportunities requires the disciplined practice of empowered execution. Individuals and teams closest to the problem, armed with unprecedented levels of insights from across the network, offer the best ability to decide and act decisively.
Chapter 11. Leading Like a Gardener. The cramped bridge of the Red October, a new Soviet nuclear submarine with stealth-like capability, is tense with anticipation as a torpedo knifes through the water toward it. Impact means instant death. First Officer Vasily Borodin. Torpedo impact 20 seconds. His serious but utterly calm commander, Captain Marco Ramius, played by Sean Connery with a distinguished beard and tailored black navy tunic, seemingly ignores Borodin's warning. He turns to CIA analyst Jack Ryan, Alec Baldwin. Ramius to Ryan. What books? Ryan, pardon me? Talking about books at this moment seems like lunacy. Ramius, what books did you write? Ryan, I wrote a biography of Admiral Halsey called The Fighting Sailor about naval combat tactics. Ramius, I know this book. Ramius appears totally engrossed with the book. Borodin, torpedo impact. Amazingly, Ramius continues the discussion. Ramius, your conclusions were all wrong, Ryan. Borodin, 10 seconds. Ramius, Halsey acted stupidly. Predictably, though others on the bridge assume they are doomed, at the last second, Ramius cleverly prevents their demise by steering his submarine directly toward the oncoming torpedo, causing it to strike before its warhead is armed. It is the apogee of heroic leadership, omniscient, fearless, virile, and reassuring. It is also almost entirely unrealistic. While some leaders possess extraordinary gifts and project a charismatic presence, in a career alongside accomplished leaders, I never met a Marco Ramius, or anyone remotely close to the character author Tom Clancy created in The Hunt for Red October. Why traditional leaders struggle. We gravitate toward heroic leaders who combine qualities we associate with leadership, such as wisdom and physical courage. For a generation after his 1815 triumph over Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo, Arthur Wellesley, the Duke of Wellington, embodied this concept. Images of Wellington on horseback, deftly maneuvering troops, established an ideal. The leader as all-knowing puppet master, crafting brilliant strategies and distributing precise commands. The organization as a rigidly reductionist mechanical beast is an endangered species. The speed and interconnected nature of the new world in which we function have rendered it too stupid and slow to survive the onslaught of predators. In some cases, it simply lumbers into tar pits, lacks the strength to free itself, and slowly dies. The traditional heroic leader may not be far behind. Yet, even in our new environment, we still retain high, often unrealistic expectations of leaders. We publicly demand high-level strategic vision and an unerring ability to anticipate broad market trends. But we simultaneously celebrate CEOs for encyclopedic mastery of every aspect of their business. We routinely ask government leaders if they knew the smallest details of an issue, and if not, why they didn't. We expect our leaders to know everything, knowing full well that the limits of technology and the human brain won't allow it. As we saw with Commodore Perry and General Grant, leadership techniques have traditionally varied with physical proximity. Up close, as long as things moved at a reasonably slow speed, a competent manager could control a military formation or an assembly line. As distances grew greater, even energetic leaders found it impossible to micromanage what they couldn't see. Railroads, telegraph, automobiles, and radio made it easier for leaders to influence developments from afar, but real control remained elusively out of reach. Even at the pace of horses or steamships, local events could develop faster than distant decision makers could monitor, assess, decide, and act. Recent technology might appear to have closed the gap between leaders and subordinates. Armed with unprecedented amounts of data, CEOs, politicians, and bureaucrats can peer into what is happening almost as it occurs. As we discussed, this information can seduce leaders into thinking that they understand and can predict complex situations, that they can see what will happen. But the speed and interdependence of our current environment means that what we cannot know has grown even faster than what we can. The doctrine of empowered execution may at first glance seem to suggest that leaders are no longer needed. That is certainly the connection made by many who have described networks such as AQI as leaderless. But this is wrong. Without Zarqawi, AQI would have been an entirely different organization. In fact, due to the leverage leaders can harness through technology and managerial practices like shared consciousness and empowered execution, senior leaders are now more important than ever. But the role is very different from that of the traditional heroic decision maker. In the task force, we found that, alongside our new approach to management, we had to develop a new paradigm of personal leadership. The role of the senior leader was no longer that of controlling puppet master, but rather that of an empathetic crafter of culture. Within such complexity, leaders themselves can be a limiting factor. While the human capacity for thought and action is astounding, it is never quite enough. If we simply worked more and tried harder, we reason, we could master the onslaught of information and urgent requirements. But of course, we can't. Author Dan Levitin explains. In 2011, Americans took in 5 times as much information every day as they did in 1986, the equivalent of 175 newspapers. During our leisure time, not counting work, each of us processes 34 gigabytes, or 100,000 words, every day. The world's 21,274 television stations produce 85,000 hours of original programming every day, as we watch an average of 5 hours of television each day, the equivalent of 20 gigabytes of audio-video images. Where once an educated person might have assumed she was at least conversant with the relevant knowledge on a particular field of study, the explosion of information has rendered that assumption laughable. One solution to information overload is to increase a leader's access to information, fitting him with 2 smartphones, multiple computer screens, and weekend updates. But the leader's access to information is not the problem. We can work harder, But how much can we actually take in? Attention studies have shown that most people can thoughtfully consider only one thing at a time, and that multitasking dramatically degrades our ability to accomplish tasks requiring cognitive concentration. Given these limitations, the idea that a heroic leader, enabled with an Uber network of connectivity, can simultaneously control 1,000 marionettes on as many stages is unrealistic. Chess Master to Gardner: The Leaders We Now Need. Considered by many to be the ultimate strategic contest between two players, the game of chess originated in eastern India in the 6th century. Once considered a game for nobility, chess was thought to be an effective tool for teaching strategic thinking to future leaders. The various pieces, king, queen, rook, knight, bishop, and pawn, behave differently. The pawns, the most numerous, are the least maneuverable. The queen is the most maneuverable, and thus the most lethal. The king, while relatively weak, is the figure that must be preserved. None can think or act for themselves. None eye the board from their unique vantage point and suggest moves. None cry warnings of danger. The chess player is all by herself to observe, decide, and act. From a distance, the task force's fight in Iraq in 2004 looked like chess. More particularly, the rushed bullet version of the game, where players have time constraints for each move. Empowered with an extraordinary ability to view the board and possessing a set of units with unique capabilities, I was tempted to maneuver my forces like chess pieces against AQI. I could be Bobby Fischer or Garry Kasparov, driving my relentlessly aggressive campaign toward checkmate. But the chess metaphor quickly broke down. Even in its most rapid form, chess is still a rigidly iterative game, alternating moves between opponents. War in 2004 followed no such protocol. The enemy could move multiple pieces simultaneously or pummel us in quick succession, without waiting respectfully for our next move. They did so with such speed that it was soon apparent that their changes were not the outcome of deliberate decision-making by seniors in the hierarchy. They were organic reactions by forces on the ground. Their strategy was likely unintentional, but they had leveraged the new environment with exquisite success. Our teams were crafted to be chess pieces with well-honed, predictable capabilities. Our leaders, including me, had been trained as chess masters, and we hoped to display the talent and skill of masters. We felt responsible and harbored a corresponding need to be in control. But as we were learning, we actually needed to let go. I leaned back on what I'd learned, not in a classroom at West Point or on a range at Fort Benning, but much earlier. In the summer of 1966, soon after my father returned from his first tour in Vietnam, my parents bought a new house. The large, early 1900s brick home gave my parents, the 6 kids, Nochi the dog, and a constant stream of visitors room to spread out. My mother, Mary, a perpetual motion machine, used part of the yard to take up gardening. No flowers. Mom was about measurable output. She grew fruit and vegetables. Beans were aligned with military precision, tomatoes on the right flank, lettuce in reserve. Napoleon would have approved, though Taylor would have moved the compost pile, my responsibility, near the fig tree, slightly closer to the squash lines, to shave seconds off labor. There were challenges. The first year, my mother overestimated the number of zucchini plants she needed, and the family suffered through every permutation of zucchini dish except ice cream. But overall, The garden was a rousing success. My contribution was spotty and occasional, but I did watch and learn. If the garden is well organized and adequately maintained, and the vegetables are promptly harvested when ripe, the product is pretty impressive. The gardener creates an environment in which the plants can flourish. The work done up front, and vigilant maintenance, allow the plants to grow individually, all at the same time. Years later, as task force commander, I began to view effective leadership in the new environment as more akin to gardening than chess. The move-by-move control that seemed natural to military operations proved less effective than nurturing the organization, its structure, processes, and culture to enable the subordinate components to function with smart autonomy. It wasn't total autonomy, because the efforts of every part of the team were tightly linked to a common concept for the fight, but it allowed those forces to be enabled with a constant flow of shared consciousness from across the force, and it freed them to execute actions in pursuit of the overall strategy as best they saw fit. Within our task force, as in a garden, the outcome was less dependent on the initial planting than on consistent maintenance. Watering, weeding, and protecting plants from rabbits and disease are essential for success. The gardener cannot actually grow tomatoes, squash, or beans. She can only foster an environment in which the plants do so. The gardener. Although I recognized its necessity, the mental transition from heroic leader to humble gardener was not a comfortable one. From that first day at West Point, I'd been trained to develop personal expectations and behaviors that reflected professional competence, decisiveness, and self-confidence. If adequately informed, I expected myself to have the right answers and deliver them to my force with assurance. Failure to do that would reflect weakness and invite doubts about my relevance. I felt intense pressure to fulfill the role of chess master for which I had spent a lifetime preparing. But the choice had been made for me. I had to adapt to the new reality and reshape myself as conditions were forcing us to reshape our force. And so I stopped playing chess. And I became a gardener. But what did gardening actually entail? First, I needed to shift my focus from moving pieces on the board to shaping the ecosystem. Paradoxically, at exactly the time when I had the capability to make more decisions, my intuition told me I had to make fewer. At first it felt awkward to delegate decisions to subordinates that were technically possible for me to make. If I could make a decision, shouldn't I? Wasn't that my job? It could look and feel like I was shirking my responsibilities, a damning indictment for any leader. My role had changed, but leadership was still critical, perhaps more than ever. Creating and maintaining the teamwork conditions we needed, tending the garden, became my primary responsibility. Without my constantly pruning and shaping our network, the delicate balance of information and empowerment that sustained our operations would atrophy, and our success would wither. I found that only the senior leader could drive the operating rhythm, transparency, and cross-functional cooperation we needed. I could shape the culture and demand the ongoing conversation that shared consciousness required. Leading as a gardener meant that I kept the task force focused on clearly articulated priorities by explicitly talking about them and by leading by example. It was impossible to separate my words and my actions because the force naturally listened to what I said, but measured the importance of my message by observing what I actually did. If the two were incongruent, my words would be seen as meaningless pontifications, Communicating priorities and cultural expectations to our team of teams spread across multiple continents was a challenge. Written guidance was essential, but memos competed with the flood of text that engulfed all of us every day. To post brief updates and observations, I used a secure web-based portal accessible to everyone, carefully composing each memo to ensure that it reflected not only my thoughts, but also my voice. I tried to remember less is more and stuck to a few key themes. Experience had taught me that nothing was heard until it had been said several times. Only when I heard my own words echoed or paraphrased back to me by subordinates as essential truths did I know they had been fully received. As a leader, however, my most powerful instrument of communication was my own behavior. As a young officer, I had been taught that a leader's example is always on view. Bad examples resonate even more powerfully than good ones. In situations where senior leaders can cloister themselves behind walls or phalanxes of aides, emerging only when their ties are straight, their hair coiffured, and their words carefully chosen, controlling the signal might be possible. But in a world of tweets and 24/7 news coverage, it is not. I didn't even attempt to hide. Instead, I sought to maintain a consistent example and message. Our daily operations and intelligence, O and I, video teleconference, became key to my overall communications effort. Although the information exchanged was the baseline product, the O and I served as my most effective leadership tool as well, because it offered me a stage on which to demonstrate the culture I sought. Early in the fight, I recognized that although I could theoretically command from any location, remaining deployed and appearing at the O&I while wearing my combat uniform against an austere plywood backdrop communicated my focus and commitment. I could demand effort from the force or support from Washington, D.C. with greater legitimacy than from any other vantage. I also demonstrated this new paradigm of leadership by demanding free-flowing conversation across the force during the O&I. The technical hurdles of creating a video teleconference for more than 70 locations, many of them isolated, bandwidth-starved bases, were huge, but the meetings had to be seamless. In the early days, I saw that interruptions in connection or other glitches undercut the perceived importance of the forum, and I could not allow that. For the same reasons, the O&I was never canceled, and attendance was mandatory. I felt that if the O&I was seen as an occasional event not always attended by key leaders, it would unravel. The rules for any meeting are established more by precedent and demonstrated behavior than by written guidance. I wanted the O&I to be a balance of reporting of key information and active interaction. That didn't come naturally, particularly across a digital medium. The participants came from different organizational cultures, were thousands of miles apart, and had never met in person. Getting candor under those conditions was not easy, but we made it work. When necessary, I would pre-plan questions or comments and plant them with trusted partners to help demonstrate to everyone what I wanted the O and I to be. Although the O and I had to be a briefing to the entire force, my role as commander remained central. Our system worked such that the person giving the brief was shown on the screen from wherever he or she was located, but the default returned to me when the brief finished. As a result, I was on live TV in front of my entire force and countless interagency partners every day for an hour and a half. If I looked bored or was seen sending emails or talking, I signaled lack of interest. If I appeared irritated or angry, notes such as, "What's bothering the boss?" would flash across the chat rooms that functioned in parallel to the video teleconference. Critical words were magnified in impact and could be crushing to a young member of the force. I learned that simply removing my reading glasses and rubbing my temple was an action that was interpreted on several continents. There were constant opportunities to lead. Each day, several intelligence analysts, typically young people I hadn't yet